Good evening. My name's Jan Rothschild, and I'm director of the Dust Poetry Series. There are mailing list cards at the door tonight, yay. They're yellow, and if you want to be on the mailing list and you're not on it, you can go over there and put your name on it. These people behind me call themselves Fiddlesticks, and this is Rick Ullman, and this is Bob Butler, and they're going to play music for a while, and then Bill Gass is going to read. So, enjoy. David Kluel and Bob Fishbone, is the musician. And that's going to be at the regular Duff's prices, which are $3 or $2 for students, and you're all welcome. And I don't think there were any other announcements. Anyway, I'm very happy to be introducing Bill Gass, who is the author of two novels, Omen Setter's Luck and Willie Master's Lonesome Wife, and a collection of short stories in the heart of the country. And he also has several collections of criticism and commentary and essays, including The World Within the Word, Fiction and the Figures of Life, and also on Being Blue. And we're very pleased to have him tonight, and I want to welcome Willie Gass.
Thank you very much. Is this mic level okay? I'm going to read tonight a part of the novel, The Tunnel, which I've been working on for so many years, as some of you drearily know. And I'm not going to say much about it because this reading will run a little over an hour, and so I want to move on. But I will say this about it. I thought I'd read what might be called the Valentine section. That is to say, it's about the nature of the limerick, and it also involves a broken heart. So I thought that might be appropriate. It is one of two sections of the novel which is about, or from the point of view, I should say, of a history professor in a Midwestern university named William Frederick Kohler. This history professor has just finished a book on guilt and innocence in Hitler's Germany. He sits down to write a laudatory preface to himself and finds himself suddenly blocked, unable to continue, and paralyzed in many ways. And begins then just to put down things, start to write things. So an anti-book emerges. This anti-book is the one I'm writing for him. Since it has a lot of things in it that are of an inflammatory and indeed despicable nature, he wishes no one to read them. They're the opposite of the public book which he has just written, and especially his wife. And since he knows his wife will never look at any important work that he has done, he hides the pages of the book that I'm writing for him in the pages of the book which he has written. Consequently, there is a shadow book, a book which we never see, but which is covering the pages of the book we do see, which is the book not meant to be seen. In this book, there are two sections which I call caricature studies. And cartoons, in a way. And this section is one of them. It will mention Martha, the narrator's wife, a number of colleagues, Governale and Planmenti, who are historians in his department, as Mistress Lou, and then the chief nemesis who gains the title of this section. His name is Culp. Culp is a calamity. He is a punishment for my sins, a plague of boils, a subcutaneous itch, a neural jangle. After everyone else has walked out of my mind, he lingers like a bad smell. Culp claims to be an historian. He claims a special knowledge of the American Indian. He heads up a troop of scouts. They make moccasins and wear them on hikes. They make arrowheads out of flints, bows from the bushes, tomahawks out of stones tied to sticks. Culp is a kind of encyclopedia of survival. He shows his kids how to create headdresses from the feathers of table turkeys and city pigeons. He teaches them how to pound stale beef, rancid suet, and raisins only rabbits drop into moist splats with a wooden mallet and shape this into sullen, indestructible cakes. He tells them it will stick to their ribs. He tells them it will help them live a long time underground. Pemmican, it's good against the bomb. 10,000 suns became one. The light burned the eyes, though the eye were itself the bulb. And I became a shadow, gray ash on a wall. Culp's kids paint their faces with berry juice and dance as though demented in ungainly figure eights. They like to take overnights, sleep on the ground, cook in tin cans like tramps, sing around a dying fire. Culp also knows about corn silk and canoes, how to smoke, how not to tip. And he has memorized some Indian chat, or so he claims, which charms the children, perhaps because his flat cheeks puff. But I think it's because they adore adults who play the fool and make themselves look ridiculous. Of course, to Culp, it matters. Deer spoor, land lie, cloud code. Culp believes. He carries his beliefs about like a charm to ward off disease. He doesn't exactly believe that beliefs are male or made of money like the Mormons, but it is easy to imagine him going from door to door, the wigwam magazine in hand, pleading to be let in so he can harangue some poor soul about the glorious history and present plight of the red man. Because he is convinced of the superiority of Indian culture and the nobility of its savages. He believes that Indian blankets are better and more beautiful than Persian rugs, that Indian horses never stumble, tire, grow old, or leave tracks, that Indian arrows fly true, that their medicine men know both men and medicine in a deep mystical sense and perform miracles as easily as we cut corns, that their squaws sow and serve, their elders advise wisely, passing the pipe of peace from hand to hand, and measuring the present by the sacred practices of the past. That therefore, their rare confederacies were more perfect unions, bound as the body is by blood. But most of all, Culp believes that the Indian is untiring, stealthy, resourceful, and stoically brave. Ah, Culp is a man of cliché, the way some men are men of the cloth. Of the loincloth, Culp would certainly say. Hence he believes that the Indian is a man of honor, and a man of his word, and a man of his bond. He believes that societies without writing are spiritually free, not stupidly becalmed. He believes in killing and roasting your own meat, growing your own grain, cleaning your own fish, tanning your own hides, slaying your enemies and settling scores, living as the sun and the snow and the seasons demand, following the great herds, worshiping bears and snakes. Culp drives a pickup with a tarp that leaks and fancies ponchos that let rain run down his neck. He pretends he can track, catch fish with his hands, make a fire by spinning his prick. Yet he lives in a little prefab the color of a dying daff, and has named his kids Deborah and Andrew. Andrew for the movie Rooney, and Deborah because everybody is born a Debbie these days. Andy and Debbie, how do you like that? Not missed in the morning, or after the name of a friendly Indian like Wawatam, or by that of the fierce and unforgiving Minavavana, chief of the Ojibways. No, Debbie, spelled D-E-B-B-Y, and Andy spelled A-N-D-I-E. On Halloween, he will set his whole troop on me, each kid naked to the waist, capering in my living room. Culp, too, with his 12 war-whooping boy sopranos, his normally smirky face chalk white, cheekbones on fire with vermilion. I always hope for frost or rain or a sudden snow that night. The little snots trying to scalp me because I've given them candy canes left from last Christmas. But why should they complain? At least it's not cookies containing pet poop or sneezing powder. One of my own kids, Carl, is in their company, but how could I have decently prevented it? Howling louder than all the others, the wretch, and brandishing his homemade tomahawk in my face. Culp insists that he can interpret the ferocious designs and symbols of Iroquois war paint, and so the children cover their arms, face, and torso with egg dye and cake color while enjoying a state of sick, self-loving, sybaritic pleasure unique to the age of 11. Culp has them rattle off the names of God knows how many Indian American Indian tribes as though they were reciting the capitals of the states. I scarcely know the makeup of the five nations. Even at the university, he springs this Indian lingo on us as if there were a jack in his mouth. To an innocent and normally unmeant good morning, he will respond with something jolly in Ojibwe. To his how, I say hile, but he thinks that's fun. Though Culp's features are far from Indian, he is lean and swarthy, with dark eyes, in fact, like Lou's. I suddenly see that. The neighborhood deceives. Still, from a distance, he seems presentable and reasonable enough. Approach, however, and you'll hear whirs and clicks, rhymes and puns, jocularities in dialect, jingles in dirty high schoolese, gibberish, he says, is pure Sioux. Culp's conversation is made up like his Halloween Indian's face. It is simply streaked with zaps, wheeps, and other illustrative noises. I guess I shouldn't say simply, or streaked either. That's not exact. His speech is not outlined or punctuated with clacks or thonks in any ordinary way. It is engulfed in them, washed with them as though they were spit. The way street sounds surrounded us, you remember, during that intense noontime tete-a-tete in a sidewalk cafe where I confessed my passion to an emptied cup and you lifted your chin to look coolly away. Yet that comparison is not correct either, since Culp's incessant zits, yelps, zooms, and hip-hips intervene. They serve as symbols themselves and carry on the action. If his pickup hasn't started, first we hear last night's icy wind and the oil in the engine thicken. The truck's doors open with a groan, which he gives us. His trousers slither over the cold seat, and the key snicks, entering the lock. The engine's frozen agonies are minutely replayed. The starter's grind, the muffled puff of a single cylinder firing. Then the smell of a flooded engine is delicately rendered by, as if from a distance, the bassoon. Finally, zerbloom! Gloom, room, room! There is a palpable silence, an emptiness in the line on the page. In the corridor, there is no one or the heart. Culp shrinks. He is shifting into another scenario. His right hand becomes a dinky little car, puck, puck, pucketing along toward school. I heard not a single pucket as I approached the crowded cafe. The clatter of the city collected like lint in an unconscious corner. The corner, perhaps, the cafe was bent around. A comic strip. Culp loved to reenact them, enliven their lines. He was surely brought up on Mickey Mouse and Porky Pig. He falsettos in fright. He zips. He squeals to a halt. He varooms. He tisks. He thonks. He does all the Popeye voices, but prefers olive oils. He has noises for the nittles, the grawlicks, the gwimps, the jarns. He blows each balloon up before your ears. He reels home, X's on his eyes, singing the spurl that rises like heat from his head. Don't ask him the time. He'll tell you it's dong, dong, dong-a-ding in 10 takes. I must admit, he does a nice imitation of Plan Man T's mind turning over. You remember, a small green hedge, not boxwood, I think, protected us from the street, and an awning striped like peppermint shaded us from an intense noonday sunshine which lay liquidly in the spoons. Remember? I'm asking what has happened, why you've changed, that old bit of emotional business, and the street sounds safeguard your answer from any other ear. I believe, Bill, you do not say, I've finally grown up. You say, remember? You say it's time to move out of the old neighborhood. What sound would Culp use to render that cut? How can a man who wants to be an Iroquois and wipe his ass with leaves go about huffing and clacking like some rusty machine? How can a man who puns with such compulsive passion believe that there is, in fact, a wealth of wisdom in the world, that these aphorisms he collects are actually true, these gnomic wise guys he reveres are really honest? How, I ask in Culp's resonant Choctaw, and in that fashion, which is firmly his, complete the joke. Ah, yes, Culp believes. He is as crammed with beliefs as goodness is in peanut butter. He believes that the hard ground is great for your back, that leaves will cure eczema, impetigo, halitosis, gonorrhea, jaundice, the Jim Jams, anything, with the exception of a few inner ailments only roots reach or bark relieves, like my gongorism, he says, which little else will touch, not even nuts, which solidify the stool or those berries which make you shit in a stream. Roots, for Culp, are another universal remedy. They can restore a missing foreskin or soothed, chapped teeth. He believes, like the drunk doesn't, in the next day. He believes that the Indians' dogs were devoted, not just hungry, that squaws were better in their blankets than a co-ed on the lawn, that Indians reared their kids to be kings, breathing nobility through nostrils taught to flare. And he papoosed his own baby all over town to improve its disposition. Don't pack the squimp on your back, he says. Put it against your chest where it can hear the heart and smell milk. He believes that alcohol pickles the liver, that cigarettes darken the lungs like the sides of caves. Yet he loves caves, firelight, primitive man and his magic markers. He believes that savages are children, but the children are pure and upright like saplings not yet bent by the wind, not yet dampened by the rain. Odd that my thoughts should be interrupted by that little round marble-top table where we sat, by a few crumbs the sparrows would eventually eat, and by the lazy strip of cellophane you'd pulled from a pack of Camel cigarettes and which now lay across the rim of your saucer. None of this was normal for you, not the cigarettes, one of which you were trying awkwardly to extract, nor the chocolate you were drinking instead of espresso, nor the cold clench to your hands, those pensive, watchful eyes which used to moisten my face with their emotion, darting by me now like startled neons. No. Bad jokes and all sorts of snappy retorts like risen bile. It was awful. She was giving me the sack. And I realized as I formed the words how she was also kicking me out of hers. I smiled. Culp smiled when he sent one of his culpograms. When the worm has eaten the apple is in the worm. A smile then, like the glassine window in a yellow envelope. I smiled. In that selfsame instant, too, I thought of the brown, redly stenciled paper bag we had the grocer refill with our breakfast oranges during the splendid summer of sex and sleep just past. Of sweetly sweating together, I would have dared to describe it then, For we were wonderfully foolish and full of ourselves, and nothing existed but your parted knees, my sighs, the torpid air. It was a bag, that bag, we'd become sentimental about, because its neck still twisted where we'd held it. You said it was as wrinkled and brown as my balls, and resembled an old cocoon, too, out of which we would both emerge as juicy and new as the oranges, like monarchs of melody, and so on. And I said to you simply, dance the orange, a quotation from Rilke. And you said, what? There was a pause full of cafe clatter. What was I doing by that time, grinning like a ghoul? Thank you for making this easier for me, did you cliché say? You said. That was when you compared me to an old neighborhood. Nothing commonplace about that. There was so much blood in my head, I heard you as if from a distance, as if my sinuses were stuffed. The flimsy red string of cellophane bloomed from the table like a strip of breeze, and I said, thank you for shopping at IGA. Just as I feel the culp come up in me when my malice, my Martha, my misery, my missus, I felt it then, losing without grace or even decency the only satisfying lover in my life, because I had put the problem in those words, getting the sack, and then seeing only the hard, oblique light from the spoons, the lift of the little length of cellophane like a sail in that short sigh of air, your smoothly filed and lacquered nails tweezing a cigarette from its pack, a fragment of tobacco clinging to one red edge, and then remembering the smell of orange peels on my fingers as if it were your own quick and not the fruits. Each step of my mind taking me further away from what was happening, and indeed, what was happening, from the terrible turn in your feelings, like the corner of the cafe, because I presume I couldn't bear to sit there and watch your tongue remove a small residue of chocolate from your lips the way you were removing me. Can I believe I've any hold on history when I find my memory is made of marimba music, sack trash, and teapot trivia? Stacks of calmly folded grocery sacks, for instance, with those silly sentences stenciled on them. Again, for instance, when I was having that soul-splitting quarrel with Martha, my misery, my missus, while she put away the groceries and I carefully flattened the bags and stuffed them in with the others to pretend to an accord until we'd take one out later to line the garbage can so our souls wouldn't dirty. Martha fitting the broccoli into the crisper and screaming at the rear of the refrigerator right at the frost line. I recreasing the foldings in the sacks, smoothing out old wrinkles and yelling back like a bull's horn. The milk still steady on its rack, you slimy word snake. Bargains galore. I'll tell you what it's like screwing you. 4 sticks of margarine, brick up the butterkeeper, a wedge of bags between tins of shortening like an elastic deck of cards, you ass-mouthed liar. At your neighborhood store, it's like trying to fuck a cooked cabbage after it's set a spell, after it's got cold, after its leaves have begun to wimp. There's a freezing wind passing through the troughs of the celery. Oh, Cole, you, what a corny conceit when your dingle, you, when your prick is a Polish pickle, she resolutely shouts, setting the jar inside and softly closing the door. I do not make the expected rejoinder. Her whole body is wide and white and seems to be as suddenly just like the Kelvinator. You've left me holding the bag. Oh, sure, when what you'd like to be holding is that skinny bit of 5 and dime baggage. Shop at Safeway, it's safer. Oh, Martha, you mean that skinny bit of baggage that this minute's giving me my sack back? And what does the stupid bag hold? It has held my childhood head, I remember, with scissored eyes and a painted mouth. I am the black knight of this one log bridge, and you shall not cross, Friar Tuck. I've killed 10 of King Arthur's clumsy champions with the backside of a plow. 3 billy goats, gruff, went down as easily as swallowing lard. I have unhorsed a heap of hot shots, too, each wearing their milady's favor, garter, scarf, or hanky. And I've done in a dozen dragons, descaled like fish. So take that and that. Pow! Well, for Christ's sake, what are you up to now? Running from symbol to symbol like someone needing to pee. She did say, my prick was a Polish pickle. What do you make of that? Would you rather be an old neighborhood? Would she have called my cock a gherkin if she had been holding a jar of those? A word with Polish roots, too, I shouldn't wonder. Indian in intention. Well, I didn't make the expected rejoinder, anticipating her reply and considering the difference between the nature of her banter and the strength of her scream. The deliberate way she put away the groceries, this into that, nothing set down stressfully, nothing slammed or banged or battered, while the words came out of her with the violence of a sneeze. This minute, Culp is composing a limerick concerning Hannibal's crossing of the Alps. It is, as he says, another chapter in his limerical history of the human race. It will have elephants in it. Hooray. That's why I gave up poetry in my youth, for history, and the novelist's art as well. He would love the way the sun lay in the bowls of our metal spoons, and the fringed shadow of the shawled edge of the candy-striped awning. See, it is crossing the table between us as if it were a fence. And surely he would have put one of us... Oh, no, surely, I'm sorry. Surely he would have one of us put that spoon's light like swallowed fire in our mouth. It would not have been your mouth the spoon went into. You were there to breathe fire, not swallow it. To tell me we were now another cliché. The uncoupled cars, spilled pearls, lost gloves. Consequently, you were nervous, 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 and had brought a quite uncustomary pack of camels on the way to the cafe, peeling the wrapper off in my presence just to get at a smoke, and not at all as if you were smiling at me and removing your clothes. Possibly that braided brown sash I gave you after the first time we made love in a real bed. Then soon looped like a length of lust itself over the foot of it. No, it was time to burn holes in all our old habits. That was what the cigarette was for. So you scooted your chair close to the table, which certainly could have been better wiped. I could see the streaks of the rag like an added design. Not to be close to me, but because it was crowded in the cafe, and I could not help but notice your slightly empurpled lips, freshly purchased, in a flap, in a rush, unquestionably the wrong shade, but as it would turn out, the right shade for this occasion, twilight at noon. Yet you could not have been a secretary, yet you could have been a secretary on her break, not a dime store doxy, and this was autumn in New York, not a malt shop in Indiana, although you ordered chocolate, a childhood sweet. Still, you didn't put a spoon in, perhaps fearing you might spill that sunshine from the silver and set ablaze like brandy. I suppose it's because I'm a little older and my age has begun to make tracks across my face like a herd of horses. I suppose it's because I've added a bit of stout to my fat. You're jealous of my piquant little breasts. Since it's certainly not because I cuff you around, have gone limp in the stiff department, lost my job, fancy another. You can't say that. Or because I won't leave my wife and fly you down to Rio. No, because you want less of me, not more. You want to re-zip our relationship, close up every opening, put a cork in on it, call the cows in. Goodbye. I can call in Culp to do the zipper's closing. You did say something finally about why. You had found a reason. Something which had been bothering you for, well, a while. A while. The same sense of while you might use to describe the shameful time you've nervously let pass since your fingers first felt, say, a lump like a small pea in your left breast. I'm afraid, Doctor, it's been there a while. Anyway, you now knew why. Why? It was because I had a loathsome mind. Loathsome, was it? A word from an English movie. A word popular with girls age 14. That was why. I said, I love you, though in a voice somewhat worn. And you said, no, quite firmly. That was why. Still, I have never been sure whether you were refusing my avowal or denying its truth. Denying its truth by affirming yours. Then your spoon went swiftly and silently into your cup. I felt fat thickening on me moment by moment, like cooling gravy. And I became the man I now am. I once went to bed with a nun who prayed the whole time it was done. She prayed to her maker to come quick and take her, so I did as she bid, and then some. When I was a kid, I always found nuns a bit creepy. I never wondered what was under those black gowns, as I'm told some kids did, because whenever I saw a nun, or even thought momentarily of one, I also saw death with more detail than a youngster can comfortably stomach. So I immediately turned my mind off like a light and plunged her darkness into mine the way she, whoever she was, had blackened her body with denial. So white underneath, like a sea worm or slug in a cave. So pale, she put each limb in relief against the black. I still feel that passing a nun on the street is more hazardous than passing a school bus. Culp is writing a series of limericks, a huge cycle, he says, endless, it seems to me, each one of which begins, I once went to bed with a nun. But for the tears of Christ, why? Why nuns? What do you hope to accomplish? The limerick, he replies, making the shame on me sign for being such a dunce. The limerick should be blasphemous where possible. Isn't that the sainted tradition? And always obscene. A clean limerick is an affront. The limerick is a tool of Satan. It must be dirty, like the toilet seats in public parks. The line which I have chosen takes care of such requirements quickly, automatically, almost prematurely, you might say. So that in the rest of the verse, I can get down to business. Culp assumes the posture of someone getting down to business. I pick nuns for the same dispassionate and professional reason that Poe chose his raven. Do you know Poe's essay on composition? I refuse to acknowledge such a stupid question. I refrain from quoting the opening paragraph. Down to business, I say, still crookedly playing the straight. You said, down to business? But what is a limerick's business? Isn't it poetry gone out of business? Isn't it a syphilitic bum, a fraudulent bankrupt, and doesn't it mug? Isn't it like a wino in rags, and won't we find it a sog and asleep under Hart Crane's bridge? Culp crows. I shall explain, he says, and I see once again that tutorial finger approaching my nose. He really crows, cock-a-doodle-doo, and so forth. Ah, the limerick. He wets and warms his lips. The limerick has a nice, tight hourglass figure, like a Gibson girl in her corset. He grins. He loves his metaphors, his rhymes, the jingles of his mind. They make him feel happy-go-lucky, as if he has change in his pocket. Well, Co, you know I like to undo that corset a little. Let what'll pop out pop. But basically it's laced as tight as time in, running out. It's as closed as the candy store cash box. He does the little bell on the shop door. Ding-a-ling. Here comes Eckstein with his huge hooked nose and greasy eyes. If Culp didn't do Jews so well, I'd think he was anti-Semitic. Eckstein looks over the counter at me. What do you want, little boy? Ah, you want an explanation of the limerick. That'll be a dime. You got a dime? I got two nickels, I say. Is that a dime? They sail over the ground in their long skirts, soft and full of silence, a lull before a lull, their carefully framed faces free of the wear of the world, like priests, too, plump as chickens. Brides, like Myrna Loy, married to the thin man. Does he come to them in the night,
when their skirts are lifted to blot out the moon and the sky? Does he come to them in his white robes like a gathering of cloud? Do they do it by mingling their nightgowns, robe rubbing robe? And do they culminate in a sliding of silks, a gossamer gasm, a whisper of holy words? I always had so many questions, but I realize now I didn't want real answers to any of them. So the point is, Culp says, the point is to use this very orderly little object, his fingers form a very orderly little object, to manufacture disorder and to confound whatever it contains. The limerick is an instrument of disrespect. It is a tune toilet, a toy box. It gossips, it slanders, it ruins, it sneers, it snobs. It's a turb tub, a cock lock. It is, Culp stands straight and stretches out his arms. He is a billboard by the roadside, a cross on a crag, an implement of revolution. I still don't understand this obsession of yours. These poor nuns, they don't live in wigwams and scalp whites. Why not use abbot or cardinal or pope if you have to blaspheme? You ask what it is I aim to achieve by writing so many, Culp declaims, holding up that admonishing tutorial finger. He's wet it. Where's the wind from? I aim to achieve perfection. He wipes his teeth clean with the backside of his tie. His teeth gleam. You wanted an abbot? A nun fell in love with an abbot and doffed both her vows and her habit. She was sadly dismayed when finally laid, for he fucked like a snake, not a rabbit. I don't know how to respond. Hey, Culp says, there's an upswing of interest in the bigots, limerick. Is that so? How about cripples? How about the poor and the maimed? Nothing stirring there, he says, but the ethnic limerick is taking off. There was a young lady, a nigger, who had a remarkable figure. She was shaped like a gun and went off just like one because her butt was both handle and trigger. That's your version of the young lady of Niger? Sure, hey, how about there was an old man of Tobago? Got to, I say. Hey, Culp grins like a mime. You wanted rabbits as a rhyme, remember? I protest, I really do, but it's useless. It really is. Abbots, I said. I suggested abbots, but it's futile. Pointless. I've no innocence left, no resistance. I am guilty of everything, or I will be. I want a rabbits as a rhyme. I want to be raped, buggered, finish me, do me in. Hey, Bill, he says, grinning like a clown cut out of cardboard. You ready? Ready? Am I ever ready? My hands muff my ears. Was I ready for the war? I sag at the knees. Was I ready for my first lay? I act almost in tears. Culp studies me. Did I anticipate my wife's fleshly animosities? I hunt up a hanky. Was I prepared to get the sack? Culp applauds by repeatedly parting his palms. I tear my hair, slap my own cheeks. He grins, grins. He loves such antics, such sad games. For hangovers, it was my habit to find the hair of the dog and then grab it. But one maddened hatter ended that matter when the hair wasn't Welsh, it was rabbit. Anyone in my profession encounters a lot of jargon during his reading life. It is to the eye like polluted air, and one gets used to it, to breathing and reading shallowly, with a hanky sometimes in front of one's face. But Culp's talk was quite otherwise. It was, if you like, so free of all professional tone and temper as to be antagonistic to it. I finally realized that he spoke carefully under every subject. Whatever it was, he was always a decade younger than necessary, so that if you wanted to discuss baseball, Culp became 14. If it were economics or sociology, he might carry on like a serious sophomore. And only about aging have I ever heard him sound mature. If the larded lingo of my colleagues, Plan Mentee or Governale, made them seem wiser than they were, like Sybil's darkly oracular, and appeared to exclude those unfamiliar with it from their community of thought, Culp's conversation was designed to make everything appear to be stupid, callow, scarcely whelped. and his language was so gee-whizzly imprecise, so stuffed to the nut with the nonce, it was no more particular than the wind, and spoke breezily to everyone like a politician at a rally. Only the future would find what he said inexplicable and have to hunt up each meaning as though it were commanded by the crossword. For by definition, the nonce lingers no longer than the daylily and disappears like that wadded-up bloom from its stem. But that's what Culp wanted and loved. If only language were made of slang and each word had a brief green life, a short season in our speech before blowing away, there would be no real enrichment of meaning, no investment over time of human thought in any inscription. The right rhymes would continue to rob signs of their significance and overthrow thrones. Hosanna, banana. Buddha, Gouda. Duke, puke. We would express ourselves in jingles. My name is William Frederick Kohler, but as I grew both fat and older, I lost the Willie and the Freddy until a simple K was ready. Though by the time I'm set to die, that withered K will be an I. And I that soon will melt away and only leave this line in clay. The soul, in his case, would open and close like a shop, save et pseudos. Punting would replace the rule of reason. If all men were mortal as soap, for the Jews there would be little hope, since the brand they have been didn't wash out but in, and why hoard such a sudless soap? And while life might become as shallow as a saucer, it couldn't hold much hate either. Suicide would be reduced to self-deprecation, the Jews' joke, the Polish put-down. Seriousness of every kind would be canceled, so the real show could go on, the celebrity roast. I've been digging into Culp's love of nonsense language, and I've decided there has to be a lot of resentment there somewhere, an immense malice for the mind. Culp recalls that I asked for a cardinal. A nun went to bed with a cardinal, whose tastes were quite plain, even ordinal. By raising her quim, she kept him plugged in till a light came on in her cardinal. After that noontime nightmare, I was not to see you again, unless the future makes fun of me and turns your person up like a letter lying doggo in a drawer. Though I've many times imagined a meeting between us, in another bar, perhaps, but in a bar as dark as the wood that built its booths. It's five-ish when life has fallen safely into the cocktail hour. The both of us are in out of the slush, out of the cheerless cold, packages under our arms. You will wear fur-topped boots and look painfully beautiful. A beer will be brought, a sherry, nothing more. A damp ring from my glass will lie undangerously on the table, a table whose top is so impregnated with plastic it gleams like a lake in the darkness, your moist, impillowed eye catching the night's vagrant light. Yes, it would be like that, so that the drift from my glass floats liquidly along like sweat on water. Have I complained again about my age? I had become an old neighborhood. You were right to move away. I'll not mention that the waiter has forgotten to bring me my nuts. Oh, what a time to be without testicles. I manage to hold my tongue without putting my hands near my mouth. I sit on my hands without sitting on my hands. That sweet smile, so malicious, so familiar, takes shape on your face. Oh, Lou, it is painful to perceive it there, forming slowly like frost. And you lean your chin on the back of your hand, oh, so winsomely, so appealingly, while you meanly mock me. Old? I don't know, you say, as though you were always old, Bill, born old, I bet, like my granddad always seemed, since I never saw him any other way than weak and wambly from beginning to end. Though I know you live cautiously, slow, looked gray, grew old as if age were your only aim. And I, too young for anyone, you said, and it was true I was, Bill, I was, yet we were young once together and thin as scarves, remember? Even though your breasts, Bill, were heavy anyway as mine, still weren't we slithery in one another's arms? Wow, they'd silk about me like those scarves I snitched from the Five and Dime. Those scarves whose colors ran together as our moistures did back then, summer under summer, when you would sweat a shower on your chest, a chain of lakes between your not-so-manly tits, summer over summer, like a heavy cloud. And you'd see colors through me, so you said. See, sure, you said you saw. Those were the days before my cradle became your grave. Wasn't that the way you spatted at me, Bill, your chewed and wadded words? Ah, God, the good old days when I said, kiss me, all it took, kiss me, and you came. A youthful thing, I'd say, like the nervous spill of a boy who thinks he has you pinned in the back seat of his father's Ford but can't get it in and gurks instead on your hand or wets your thigh. Because it's still his papa's prick, too, he's borrowed for the evening and can't handle any better than he can the car. Well, it was rather nice, nevertheless, for an old man to fumble and go off like a boy, a young time thing. Though you were always old, born old, I bet, old-eyed and cold inside, snowy as suet. Oh, Lou, that's when my play dreams dissipate. Suddenly you're saying such things, and worse, forcing me to close down the show, distickling my fancy. I regraze the shallow pastures of your upper thighs when suddenly you're boxing my ears. I recreate a nipple, lean near to nuzzle, when suddenly I see an unhealed wound. Daymare after daymare gallops me away from your memory. Suddenly your sweet face sneers. Your soft voice curses me, you Finth, you clerch. I cannot connect you any longer to my life, not without a shock. Not even your image will behave. At least that much of you should be my slave. The fault is yours, my dear. Culp is here again, like a nagging cough. He reminds me that I said I would prefer the Pope. He's wearing a huge button which says, let's put the Indian back in Indiana. A nun went to bed with the Pope, who tied her four limbs with a rope. It's not that, my dear, you have something to fear, but I want you quite still so nothing will spill when your holiness is filled by the Pope. I squat clumsily and pretend to defecate in the corridor. Is that the way to respond? Culp thinks so. I'm a card, a great kidder, a regular Joe. I am an old neighborhood. I have a loathsome mind. You start to rise, a bit awkwardly, because the chairs have been set so close together, some of their wire legs have intertwined. My hands are palm up on the table in what I take to be a gesture of supplication. You are latching your purse. I remember the sound. Between a click and a clack, perhaps a snock culped you. Would that be right? And I try to scrub my mind clean of the sign's sticky duplicities, but it's no go. I hear Iago advising Rodrigo. She must have change, she must. Therefore, put money in thy purse. Lou's cunt is closing like a flytrap. Snunk. I feel the hands bag. I read the pockets book. I lap my last lap. So she stands, has stood. I am holding my tongue while keeping my hands palm up upon the table. Perhaps someone will drop a dime in them, Bill, her voice says. For she says nothing. Her voice says, Bill, it is the last time I will hear my name in her mouth. How wise we were to meet in such a public place where it is guaranteed I will not blubber, curse, or plead. A dissolution neat as her ensemble. Bill, it begins, but then her voice breaks off, and we are broken. I am broken. Bill, that's all. All. My God, all? That was all. And she is slipping sideways out of my sight. Has slipped. the food that to him now is as luscious as locusts shall be to him shortly as bitter as coloquintida. Culp is wearing a large badge which reads, "Bring back the badge." Your clothes, as you rise, readjust. They slip into something smooth and stiff, like the uniform of a nurse. The edge of the table presses against your belly. The purse yawns, catches the camels, closes. They are bitter as coloquintida. Closes, snock. Dark glasses cover you suddenly with the brown of a fruit's bruise, the brown of something brown in its seeds. I am seen. How must it be when they go at it, Culp and his wifey? What sound accompanies the elevation of her nightie? A medal hangs from his naked neck. It says, "Peace." To be the pressing edge. To glimpse again your soft white shoulder. That nostalgia most painful for the flesh. That former form. To slide your sweat-slick skin. To be the pressing edge. I never understood what makes another body so appealing. But to glimpse again by sorrow's side your soft white shoulder, soft as your slip. Is it because we age, we die? Ah, to otter on down you, to lie along the length of you again, slide your sweat-sweet skin to be the caressing edge. Over the Alps on an elephant, Culp yodels, went Hannibal out of his element. And during that merciless noonlight, Lude had delivered the final thrust, a quite conventional coup de grace. But inside the banality of the blow, there was a fresh blade. It was time to move to a new neighborhood. No matter the matter of it, the pain was as stale as the stars. Nothing new in it, nor in my compliant posture, dog cower. Haven't you got our holy prepositions and positions mixed, I now imagine, myself saying. Don't you mean you're thinking of moving on to a new neighbor? Which proves I'm as complicated as ever and unfazed, unfoxed. One riposte on toast. Or shall I play dazed, as if I didn't understand, hadn't caught the cut across my heart, even though I'd had a warding hand up? She stands, and the edge of the table presses itself against the place where she is divvied. It was that last cold and indirect caress I could not bear. Never more to do the downy. And so I rose, without the least sense of bloom or blush or black spot, and wriggled my way between the tiny tables. Oops, so sorry, pardon me, amid the talk. Olga never thinks of me. All she does is buy shoes. The shadows are so distinct they seem made of paper. Excuse me, please. That's a nice nod. Pardon me there. Please excuse. Through the clatter of the cups, spoons, Zippo snicking, auto calls, purse clush, out into and under the bright summer swallowing autumn day, its whitewashed sky, where Lou was entering a cab, not even affording me a final flash of her leg, for her car was already drawing away from a curb gray as ash and moving out among the other glints, while behind me whole walls of window consumed her swimming image. How wholly ordinary were we? Ah, God, utterly. A nun went to bed with a barber. With his razor, she feared, he would carve her. You will have to behave, for your cunt's close shave means you steady the tool of this barber. Culp, I say, with wonderment like a wreath about my earnest face, don't you find those Eddie Lear-like last lines a little too predictable and pillowy? Sic et non, he says. Jeez. Well, sure, he says agreeably, it's obviously easier to find two rhymes than three, and sure, you land soft. It does seem a sin, she says, but the thing is, repeating the last line only feels like a breeze, he says, blowing his breath in my direction. And there's no automatic built-in bite to it, But the thing is, that's exactly the challenge, Coley, you bet. That's the nom that says Sikkim to the oak. Jeez. Because it's 10, 20 times 30 harder to write the soft version and still come up with something snappy. Look, he says patiently, suppose I began, with a faggot whose crimes were quite heinous. Well, a line like that lets you get ahead of it like a cop on a cycle, doesn't it? You're there in the station when the train arrives. So the problem is to create a little surprise, nevertheless, like a faggot whose crimes were quite heinous kept a switchblade sheathed in his anus. See, you didn't expect that, did you? You were looking to hear rear, all right, old anus, but switchblade now. Isn't that a punch in the solar? Yeah, and when he was screwed, his buggers were chewed. Get the nice twist there. Really, this scorned form requires patience, art. So when he was screwed, his buggers were chewed by that asshole for which he was famous. Now, isn't that one something? Isn't that a full fab for a wash night? My land. I've also done a dirty on the Pope, which demonstrates what every success succeeds in demonstrating, namely, the essence of success itself. I know, I protest. I do know. I've heard it. You've told it to me. You've recited it. A nun went to bed with the Pope, who immediately started to grope, Culp whispers, as if imparting a secret. I find the words dismayingly unfamiliar, but I insist on my complete recollection of them anyhow. My complaints, my avowals are useless, of course, useless, futile. So I begin to back away, my back to the bulletin board where Culp has tacked up a cartoon. For the place neath her dress, I am facing away and walking off, even rudely, I'd like to sashay, but it doesn't matter, his meters follow my feet. Which he wanted to bless, he shouts in a whisper after me. I do my chores, pretend to want Martha. Because I can't dance, I take her dancing. Fancy some firelight to stare at. Meanwhile, Culp does fowl in the barnyard, geese in the sky, a train entering a tunnel, a plane pulling out of a dive. He does dog noises, sure, it's no surprise. He can whine, yelp, growl, howl, and bay with the worst of them. He likes to represent to you a neighborhood in the early morning as the milkman wakes it. First the horse comes clippity down the dawning street. The bottles rattle in their wire baskets, chink-a-clink. Next, a chunk, for the cold bottom of the bottle has come to rest on the stoop. A moment of silence for rising cream. Then one dog outcries, soon another. He hopes you will appreciate the milkman's noisy progress. He hopes you will admire the difference of the breeds. A nun went to bed with a sailor who said he had come from a whaler. It was like Moby's Dick, his blubberous prick, with which he promptly assailed her. And after the sailor impaled her, he said to the nun, whose voice failed her, "Gee whiz, madame, you ain't built like a man and don't come like the boys on the whaler." My business is with history, my quarrel too. The things I remember about that September day, brittle little sounds speckled against all those incessant voices, monotonous as a fan's hum, the hard, bright light, my palm up, pity imploring hands, loose outfit, I guess that's the right word, her uncharacteristic cup of chocolate, camel cigarette, and so on. Oh, God, and the pressing edge. These do not belong in history. They lie along its lip like the milk always did around my kids' mouths. They are what clings to the spoon you've used to stir your drink, the residue which wets the saucer, which remains in the ring, the cup leaves, when put imprudently down on a piece of paper or on a countertop to be wiped away by a waitress. This is history. Over the Alps on an elephant went Hannibal out of his element, for the elephant's motion was so like the ocean he continually punicked upon his best tunics and his slaves had to wash off the elephant. I never know how to respond. It was a bright and sunny day. I said we met in a sidewalk cafe. She entered as though in a play. The ash on the wall I was gray. We greeted in a formal way. Neither of us could at first find a thing to say. Is it true what you wrote me, that you're going away? Yes, I'm going away to stay. I said, dare I tell you of my dismay? It's a frightful decision. I wish you'd delay. Don't make a scene, she said, a display. The waiter's tray slid with his presence between us. A cup clicked in its saucer. My nerves had begun to fray. I feared I might weep, and my eyes grew hot, their rims red. I don't think we should betray all our former feelings. No, my love, she said, it's really time for me to move on to a new neighborhood. You've had from your loo your last lay. I don't know how to respond. I said we met. Okay, but did we? If by meeting one means the purposeful approximation of two or more persons, then we met, yes. A half-hostile conjunction. No touching, though. No berating. No meeting in that sense. In the sense of a meeting, there was never any meeting. There were merely some incidents which I later shuffled together like a hand of cards and called a meeting, and beneath which, beneath that calm and covering name, the actual events disappeared like a table under lace and embroidery. My shoes carried me there, but they were not a part of any meeting. Hitler, Chamberlain, and their suits and shoes meet in Munich. The place where the meeting occurred was no more a part of our meeting either than the rabbit's snare is an ear of the rabbit. The day, the autumn, awning, awfulness, the strip of cellophane that blew lazily away. Yet erase these, remove the waiter's tray, the cool spoon between Lou's long fingers, and there's no meeting. Lou was not there when I arrived for our meeting. Our meeting had arrived ahead of her. I stood stupidly on the passers-by side of the hedge and searched unsystematically for a place. The sun made my eyes smart. Two seats were vacant, but they were out of the shade, in the squint, and on one I thought I saw a smear of custard. My heart was already racing. A man with a half-eaten brioche on his plate, his last bite still visibly indented in the eaten edge, folded his Times uncomfortably under his arm and rose, without the least sense of bud or bloom or black spot that I could see, to make undulating way between the tables. Rather gracefully, I believe, I thought, out into the street, a barrier which he quickly and efficiently crossed. Don't order brioche. Okay. You said, okay. Until that moment, I hadn't realized that you never said, okay. I say, yeah, a lot, more than is normal or necessary. But in your unfamiliar strict gray skirt and unbuttonable blouse, you said it. Yeah. Okay, I won't order brioche, but I do think I'll have a cup of cocoa. Cocoa. It went wearily with my name. You came up the street, all very trim and tidy, as though on your lunch hour, secretary in the city. Certainly not a clerk in a dime store anymore, now quite executive, fucking your way up, as Culp would smugly point out if he knew, and no longer impressed by my mind, which had become loathsome finally. Or had been finally seen for what it was, loathsome, in hose and heels. May no jokes culp up in my mouth in my misery. You probably can't see this. It's written on a grocery sack. May no silly sallies soil, no wounding witticisms wound. Please, no employment of my extensive verbilities. No reposts, no rejoinders, however easy and irresistible the opening offered. Don't I notice now how clean of heavy jewelry your hands are, your nails of garish gloss, a tasteful oval shape instead of the glistening spear point they once were, and how your watch band is as slim and silver as a small, swift fish, that your blouse is very pretty, even if. And don't I resentfully recognize that they are each one my improvement. They are my long lawn, my envied bed of blooms, bed from which I'm being barred, position of thrust from which I am, after a moment here of stirring and staring down. The shade has made my eyes swoon, going to be firmly and efficiently sacked. There was no meeting. Meetings are the imaginings of history. And if I had not seen that smear of, what was it, custard on that chair, perhaps I would have had to sit there in the sun's scrutiny, the glare so severe you would have had to squint when you looked up at my woeful face, when you spoke to my drooping ears. And maybe you wouldn't have felt you could say the things you said if at the same time you were unattractively wrinkling up. And then there wouldn't have been any separation either, no grim goodbye, no broken bill, no fondleless fare thee well. But we all know that thrown shoes don't lose battles, bring down empires either. You would not have been impeded by such a small stone flung in your path, not even by so many as would have paved it with gravel.